Welcome back to Clinicians Brief, the podcast, the conversations behind the content. I'm your host, Dr. Alyssa Watson, and I'm joined today by Dr. Jennifer Good, a clinical assistant professor in the Emergency and Critical Care Department at the University of Georgia. Dr. Good and I will be discussing her experiences with a case of a puppy that was found unresponsive after chewing on an electrical cord, and using that case to highlight how to properly diagnose and treat non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. Dr. Good's article, entitled Electrocution Emergency in a Puppy, was featured in the April-May 2021 edition of Clinician's Brief. Hi, Dr. Good. Thanks for taking the time to chat with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Before we dive into this really interesting case, would you tell our audience a little bit more about your background and your clinical interests?
Sure. I am originally from New York City. I grew up there. I went to school there. I went to vet school at Cornell up in Ithaca, and then did an internship in New Jersey and my residency at the University of Pennsylvania. I did not initially in vet school think I would go into emergency, but during my internship, it was very ER heavy. And at the time, and probably some out there can relate, in my early 20s, it seemed like a really good idea in terms of, like, who cares about holidays and weekends? But anyway, I fell in love with ER and with the ICU, and so then went on and did my residency. I would say clinically, I am very lucky that in my current position, one of my favorite things is teaching, and I get to do that both with students as well as interns and residents. And it's just so gratifying because, as I think we all feel, this is a really, really tough profession to be in, especially now. And any little joy you can take from it is really important. And so I really love teaching. I also got certified in veterinary acupuncture a few years ago, and it's been a dream of mine to bring acupuncture more into the emergency critical care world because we use it a lot in rehab, but I think it has a lot of really good applications in the ICU. So that's where I'm trying to push the envelope right now.
That's wonderful. And I read on your bio too, because I stalked you a little bit before this conversation, that you actually perform acupuncture on multiple species. So you're seeing horses and everything as well, right?
Yes. Yeah. I did my training at the Chi Institute in Florida. And when I did that, I specifically wanted to do mixed animals so that I would have a broader base. UGA actually now does have a large animal field services veterinarian who also does acupuncture. So she's taken over much of the large animal stuff, but I've been able to get my fix doing a lot of exotics because I also do wildlife rehab. So I've been using a lot of acupuncture. The exotic service lets me do birds and reptiles and all that kind of stuff. So I haven't had a good horse in a while, but I have had some good birds. So,
well, that's great.
<There's> that.
Well, let's jump back into the world of dogs and cats. And we're going to talk a little bit about this case and this article you wrote. It centers around a 6-month-old intact male mixed breed dog. His name was Charlie. Can you tell us how you became involved in this case?
Sure. So Charlie initially presented to the emergency service at the University of Georgia. He was brought in quite emergently by his owners. And so that's where I first encountered him, in our emergency room. And then he was moved into the ICU. So for the time that he was hospitalized, I was also dealing with his case while he was getting his supportive care in the ICU. So I was able to sort of follow him through.
Excellent. And now Charlie, you know, obviously he had been found by his owners chewing on an electrical cord, and he was unresponsive when they brought him in. Is that correct?
Yes, he was. I think primarily when unresponsive, obviously, is sort of a broad term. And so just to sort of clarify, unresponsive in this case meant in severe shock. He was in cardiovascular shock secondary to the trauma, basically, that his nervous system had experienced along with the hypoxemia. And so he mentally was not appropriate and was very, what we say, shocky, very tachycardic, and his blood pressure wasn't great. It was borderline and, you know,
mentally dull. Yeah. And is he the typical signalman for patients with this type of injury? I assume that you probably see this a little bit more in younger, more curious, mouthy patients.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, inevitably, for a lot of these, and we'll talk more about the pathophysiology later, but for anything that involves even a head trauma or certainly electrocution, it tends to be the younger animals. Also, because a lot of these guys are maybe a first pet in a household, just similar to when you have your first child, you know, if you go that route, it's, you have to learn to baby proof the house. And so I think sometimes people don't know exactly what to look out for until it happens. And then, you know,
yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, is there anything that owners can do first aid wise, or that you recommend they administer at home prior to bringing that pet in, or just get them in absolutely as fast as possible?
Yeah, unfortunately, with something like electrocution, there's really not a lot that you can do at home. It's not like a wound that's bleeding that you can try and apply pressure to, or a heat stroke where you can actively go ahead and cool them. The damage has already occurred. And so at that point, they just need to be brought into an emergency room ASAP. It'd be nice if there was something in the interim, but there just really isn't. Those are times when you just need to get them in.
Yep. Unfortunately, this is a time you just get them in to the nearest ER that you can.
Yep.
So when they come in, what is the first step, you know, in triaging these patients when they come into the ER?
Yeah, absolutely. So triage is such an important topic and thing to really be able to do right off the bat. So we talked about the mental state. So the sort of the four body systems that we're looking at immediately is the cardiovascular system. So their perfusion, are their mucous membranes pale or very red? Are their pulses very poor? Are they very tachycardic? Do they have an arrhythmia? And then there's the respiratory side, you know, taking a look, does that animal look like they are breathing normally? Do they look like they are in distress? Do they look like they're not breathing at all? And then the neurologic system, what is their mentation? You know, do things look awry? Are the pupils different sizes? You know, is there anisocoria? Is there mental dullness, stupor? And then for cats, especially the urogenital system, not so much in this case. So all three of those things sort of need to happen at once. So for instance, for Charlie coming in, it was apparent he was not appropriate. His mucous membrane color was not very good. His breathing was not normal. And he was very tachycardic and seemed to be in shock from that standpoint.
So I assume then your next steps were to try to stabilize that and then get some diagnostics.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of them, it's a very blunt way to put it, but the way I see it is that, you know, what's going to kill you first? And so getting x-rays is not going to really help me if my patient's dead. And so the first order of business is to get an IV catheter in, give some flow by oxygen if you have it, and then try and get fluids into the animal if appropriate, or get other medications if that's appropriate. Warm them up if they need that, cool them down if they need that, and just get them more stable so that you can move forward to figure out what's underneath it all.
Okay. So once you have them stabilized, you had mentioned radiographs, that these are probably quite important when we're trying to diagnose, pulmonary edema from any source, whether it be cardiac or non-cardiogenic. So how does this appear radiographically?
So in this case, we're looking at what's called non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. And radiographically, it can look similar to heart failure, which is cardiogenic pulmonary edema. The difference is that with any type of non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, it will be bilateral, whereas with heart failure, sometimes it will just be right-sided. It may not, you know, it's going to be bilateral. It is going, when you look at those lateral projections, you can definitely appreciate that it's caudodorsal. So whereas an aspiration pneumonia might be more likely to be more cranial, this will be caudodorsal and it will be bilateral. And then you can look at your heart size as well. And if, you know, the left atrium is not large, then that is also a clue.
that this is probably not related to the heart. Are there, right. Do you find that there might be some other radiographic findings, especially in young animals, that might trip clinicians up, you know, remembering things like thymus and things like that?
Sure. A really good point. Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to remember that even little things like growth plates may still be in place, and that includes on the ribs. Sometimes those can look like lesions or breaks to the ribs, and it's just a normal growth plate within the costochondral junction. Certainly the thymus is another thing that good old sale sign can make you think that maybe there's something in the mediastinum that's not normal. The other thing is a lot of puppies tend to be on the thinner side, as well, I certainly was when I was younger, and maybe many of us can say the same. And so that's going to mean that your serosal detail, it may not be. And again, we're talking about lungs, so it's not as big a deal, but it's important to remember that your detail may not be the same as it would be in that big old fat lab that we're looking at down the road in, you know, 6 years.
Excellent. That's a wonderful thing to remember as well. So beyond radiographically, if you have, if clinicians have ultrasound, which, you know, many of them in emergency setting do, what are the ultrasound findings when we're dealing with non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema?
This is where I think it gets a little tricky, because thoracic ultrasound for trauma, which is, you know, why it was invented, is fairly nonspecific in terms of the underlying cause. So when you have any infiltrate in the alveoli, whether that be pus from pneumonia or cardiogenic edema or non-cardiogenic edema, you will see what we call B lines, or the rocket sign. Mm-hmm. So instead of a glide sign with your lung lobes kind of coming together smoothly, you have these projections coming down that swing back and forth like a pendulum. That lets you know that there is infiltrate within the alveoli, but it doesn't really tell you specifically what that is. However, if you look at the heart and you see a giant left atrium in tandem with these B lines and a murmur, let's say, although, you know, you don't always have that, but that may help you a little bit more than what the infiltrate in the lung is, trying to see if you think it's heart versus not.
Yeah, excellent. So those were some good tips about radiographically and ultrasound, how to differentiate the two. I read about this method of looking at the pulmonary edema, like the edema fluid to plasma protein ratio. Is this something that you do? I don't know if they do it more in humans where they compare.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's, and that's a, and you know, I probably were constrained somewhat by time, but it's actually an incredibly important distinction if you are trying to figure out what type of edema it is, because a cardiogenic edema is going to be secondary to hydrostatic pressure. You know, we kind of go back to our Starling's forces, and we have this increased hydrostatic pressure because we've got back pressure on the pulmonary circulation, which is, it's a very low stress, if you will, vascular body, because it needs to have a lot of give, but eventually the pressure becomes too big. And so that hydra, it's water. And so the solids of that, the total solids, will actually be quite low versus something like a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, where it's secondary to leakage, inflammation in those vessels of the pulmonary circulation. And so that's closer to plasma, because it's actually leaking through the vasculature. And so with something like ARDS, acute respiratory distress syndrome, you're going, if you have fluid, now, of course, if you have fluid pouring out of your patient, you know, it's like that ship has sailed, but but you can get a total solids, and that will be more in the neighborhood of 4 to even 6.
Wow. Okay.
Electrocution's rough because it's a little bit of both. Yeah, which is frustrating, but it's still worth it to take a look.
To take a look and try. And that's a, you know, possibly quick method to try to determine what's going on.
Absolutely.
So how did you then move forward to treat Charlie with his pulmonary edema?
So once, and of course, in this case, the history helped a whole lot. These owners could tell us what had been going on. And so we knew that it was probably a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema secondary to the electrocution that we knew had happened. In terms of treatment, the vast majority of it is supportive care. So oxygen therapy, oxygen, oxygen, more oxygen. I always say, unless you're on fire, oxygen is never wrong. So giving him oxygen, a lot of times these guys need a little bit of sedation, sometimes some, you know, butorphanol if they're not, that's not great for pain, but if you just need to calm them down because they're terrified, they can't breathe, they don't know what's going on. With non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, unlike cardiogenic, where your first order of business is going to be giving a diuretic, usually Lasix, furosemide, it's a little less clear with non-cardiogenic. There are sources, both in human and veterinary medicine, that do advocate for giving at least one small dose, because it will hopefully, if there is any hydrostatic part of it, help to clear that. But it's not good to continue it, because in the case of Charlie, he was in shock and he actually needed IV fluids. He needed to be resuscitated that way because he, you know, he was having a systemic failure and it wasn't his heart. And if you continue giving Lasix, you're actually decreasing that cardiac output and that preload that the body really needs to keep going. And so he needed IV fluids. In his case, he also had some pretty bad burns at the commissures of his mouth. And so he did need better pain medication. So in a case like that, you're looking more at a pure mu opioid. So methadone or, you know, hydromorphone, whatever you have.
Are there any particular pain medications or other drugs that clinicians need to steer clear of when they have a case like this?
I think you just need to be aware of how cardiovascularly taxing the drug is that you're giving when you have a patient that's in shock. So something like Dexdomitor would not be a good choice. Now, Charlie was a young, otherwise healthy dog. And so in any other circumstance, sure. But when that patient is in shock, you don't want to give a medication that's going to cause compromise to the cardiovascular system that is already under stress. So something like dexmedetomidine, I would not recommend. I think sometimes just a spit of acepromazine is not contraindicated, but obviously if you have a patient with very low blood pressure, you might want to steer clear of that. Most of our pure mus are okay. You know, yes, they can depress it a little bit, but they're far more likely to depress the respiratory system, which in this case isn't always bad. You know, they're already in oxygen and kind of can take the edge off. And as long as they're able to blow off their carbon dioxide, it's usually okay.
Looking for CE that clicks? Enhance your skills with practical online CE for the cases you see every day. Clinician's Brief CE is race approved, affordable, and convenient for your busy schedule. Choose your next course today at cliniciansbrief.com/CE. So you had touched transiently on the ulcers and lesions in Charlie's mouth. Can we talk a little bit more about the treatment for those?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's really along the same lines as wound care, except the frustrating part is that it's in the oral cavity and around the oral cavity, so stuff doesn't stick as well. I like magic mouthwash, which means different things to different people out there probably. The way I think of it is using sucralfate and a little bit of lidocaine. I know there are other formulations, but I think anything you can do to stop the pain. So that's where something topical like lidocaine comes in. And then if you can coat as well as you can. And then sometimes putting a little bit of salve on there, triple antibiotic ointment, or, you know, I don't personally use, you know, silver sulfadiazine on a mouth. That seems like it could go wrong. But anything that can just sort of help to soothe that area. And it's important to just know that you're going to have to reapply those treatments quite often. You know, if you're putting a topical something on the lips, it's going to, you know, go away pretty quickly. And so just being on that, making sure they're getting Q4 to 6 treatment for that.
And then how long does it take for those ulcers or lesions typically to heal? Are we treating for a few days?
Yeah, you know, the beautiful thing about mucous membranes is they bleed like the dickens and they hurt, but they heal really fast. And so in general, if there's not ongoing insult, like, you know, severe uremia or some reason to continue to have ulcers, they will heal up in an otherwise, you know, healthy animal who's improving within a couple of days. And these guys are amazing. They can start eating within 1 to 2 days if they're feeling well enough. You know, if you have severe oral trauma, then you're probably looking at putting in something like an esophageal feeding tube. But that is, I don't know that I've ever seen that be the case with something like an electrocution. That's usually something really traumatic that happens within the mouth. And so they heal up really well. Most of them, because I just imagine maybe listeners have a question about antibiotics or no antibiotics, which is, you know, always the, what do we do?
What do
antibiotics
we do?
Or antibiotics? Yeah. Yes, I grapple with it constantly. It is just a constant battle. In this case, if things are healing up really well, I would steer clear, because you are then, this animal's already going to maybe be reticent to eat. And there's no evidence, if you're cleaning the wounds and taking care of them, that they're getting infected. The non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema is sterile. It's coming straight out of that vasculature. And so there's not really a good reason, unless something, of course, happens in your treatment that, you know, they've spiked a fever or something else is going on. But in general, antibiotics are not necessary in these guys, and those wounds will heal up pretty fast.
That's really interesting. Do you ever see burns in any places other than the oral cavity with these?
With electrocution?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. I mean, with our patients, the vast majority of them get electrocuted because they're chewing on them, versus humans, you know, children that maybe stick their finger in. You can have a burn anywhere where you have, especially where you have low resistance, because electricity loves water, right? And and so anything that's not blocking it is going to allow it to conduct better, which is why mucous membranes are so much more prone to burns. But if an animal was near a live wire, it got on their abdomen, absolutely, you could have burns on any area, usually of non-haired skin, because the hair will really help to, the fur rather, I should say, will really help to give a protective layer. But there's no reason you can't see burns somewhere else. It's just that, you know, 99.9% of our patients were being little goobers and chewing on the wire.
And chewing on something they shouldn't have. Yep. So, yeah. So just with non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema in general, are there other causes that we see frequently besides electrocution?
Oh, absolutely. So when we talk, and this is touched on a bit in the article, when we talk about electrocution or seizures, head trauma, we're talking about something, it's under the umbrella of non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, but it has its own pocket of neurogenic pulmonary edema. And the reason it's in that pocket is because if I bite down on an electrical cord, my system flight or flight goes into overdrive, and there is a massive release of catecholamines that will then cause my blood pressure to spike. I also have inflammation. That's why the fluid is a little bit mixed. So I have increased hydrostatic pressure plus endothelial leakage. But probably in practice, where most people will see non-cardiogenic edema will be secondary to suffocation, usually upper airway obstruction. And if you are lucky enough, like me, to live in an area where every other human has a French bulldog or an English bulldog, you see it quite a lot. They also aspirate a lot. But if an animal has that sort of a choking, if they drown, if they are strangled, or if they just have a defective upper airway, they can, all that negative pressure trying to breathe in will create inflammation that can create non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. And one other point I also think is important to remember is that anything that causes systemic inflammatory response syndrome, So if you have an animal hospitalized that has bad pancreatitis, that has had, you know, intestinal surgery and has had a septic abdomen, is having trouble coming back from it, any of those patients are at risk for non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, because part of the complex of systemic inflammatory response syndrome is that there is a battle between anti-inflammatory and inflammatory mediators. Inflammation wins. That means vessels get leaky everywhere, and that includes in the lungs. And so if you have a patient that is starting to have a change in their breathing pattern, yes, they may have aspirated, but they may very well have non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema.
So I would assume then that the prognosis really depends on the underlying cause. You know, in Charlie's case, when we're looking at that acute electrocution, you know, trauma in a young, otherwise healthy animal, my understanding is the prognosis is fairly good with aggressive treatment. Can you tell us a little bit about the prognosis and how that differs for the types of non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, fortunately for Charlie and for patients like him, young, otherwise healthy animals that have had the acute insult, if they can get past the first couple of days and have everything die down, you know, their body sort of calms down, they get supportive care, the vast majority of them will do very well. Of course, there are exceptions to the rule. If you, you know, just can't breathe or you need to go on a ventilator and that is not realistic for your family, it wouldn't be realistic for mine, I get it, then that may be a different outcome. But most of these guys do very well versus, let's say, that really, you know, older diabetic patient with bad pancreatitis that develops ARDS or, you know, acute respiratory distress syndrome secondary to SIRS, their prognosis isn't going to be as good because there are so many comorbidities. And it just, it makes their body is so tired, you know, it makes it a lot harder for them to have the ability to clear that fluid over time because they're battling so many other things. So in general, the neurogenic pulmonary edema, you know, an acute seizure, a young puppy that gets its head stepped on, we see a lot of that too, or an animal like Charlie will do better, both because they are younger and healthier and because the underlying etiology of what got them to the hospital is not as bad.
Right, right. And what are the criteria that clinicians should be using to gauge improvement and know when is it okay that these patients can be discharged and monitored at home or continue, you know, their recuperation at home?
Yeah, great question. So it's one of those, if only there was a yes, black and white answer. It's so fluid. And of course, as the clinician treating the animal, you have the best insight into it. I think if you have an animal that is not apparently oxygen dependent, and I will be the first one to say that, at least for me, pulse ox machines work, I don't know, 50, 75% of the time. So you can't always bet on that. You can do an arterial blood gas, but that is also not realistic for a lot of folks. What I tell the students and the doctors training is treat your patient. Look at your patient. If your patient is breathing comfortably on minimal oxygen or off oxygen, odds are they are okay. Just like the animal that is incredibly dyspneic that someone's trying to put a pulse ox on, newsflash, it's bad. So I think if you look at that patient, they look like they're breathing comfortably. They are able to at least lick some wet food. They, you know, they are able to be up and walking around. I think it's perfectly reasonable to say at that point, you know, I think we're okay here. And you monitor them carefully at home and you know, we can make sure that if they're still in pain or they're not eating well, we can do something about a feeding tube, but they should be good to go.
Excellent. And is there like a role for monitoring resting respiratory rates and things like that then for people at home to know if they should be concerned and bring them back?
Sure. Yes. Yes. It's a double-edged sword. As we all know, sometimes you give owners a task and they're a little too good at it. You get your phone just blows up like all the time.
Or you get an email with like respiratory rate every 30 minutes for 2 days.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh my gosh. Yes. I think that you can, what I usually say, rather than giving them a number, because, mm-hmm. you know, a number can get kind of dangerous, if they visit their pet and, you know, their pet is relaxed in a room with them after the initial happiness, I'll sometimes ask them to look at how they're breathing right then. Do you mm-hmm. see how, you know, Fluffy is breathing right now? That's good. You know, if it seems like at rest, Fluffy is not resting, you know, it looks like it's a lot faster. And that way you don't have to necessarily give a number. But I also think it's okay to tell owners that if Fluffy is fast asleep and you count, you know, 45 breaths in a minute, that's not normal. That's not okay.
Wonderful. That's really good information. You know, I've learned so much. I learned so much from this case, and I was just really excited that you were able to come on and talk a little bit more about it. So our regular listeners know this is the time where I kind of put our guests on the spot a little bit.
Uh-oh.
Actually, it's not, you're not really on the spot. There's no right or wrong answers. But we like to have a little fun at the end of the episode where we play a game of kind of would you rather. Do you want to play with us quick?
Absolutely. Hit me.
Awesome. Okay. Would you rather examine an aggressive Chihuahua or an aggressive Great Dane?
I'm going to go with Great Dane. I think there are those out there that can feel me on that. Although it's harder to throw a towel over the Great Dane, but I don't know. I think a Great Dane.
I agree with you. I always go with the large dog too. So
yeah.
Would you rather place a catheter in a dehydrated kitten or an obese dachshund?
Ugh, dehydrated kitten.
Okay.
Question. Yeah, no, mostly because maybe I just go IO. That's
cheating.
Okay, the cheating. Yeah, no, I still think I'm going to go with the kitten.
Still go with the kitten.
Yeah.
Would you rather learn a new skill every year or hone one skill so that you were the best in the whole world at that one thing?
I would rather learn a new skill every year.
Yep.
Absolutely. I will never be the best at anything. All I can do is trying to keep improving. And I say this to myself and I say it to my students. If you get to a point in this job where you are not still learning things from people around you, from your owners, from your patients, then you should hang it up. Like, we have to keep learning.
Keep learning every day. Would you rather hunt for a difficult to find ovarian remnant or a pancreatic tumor with your ultrasound?
Oof. I guess I'm going to say pancreatic tumor, although that is really mean because everyone knows a pancreas is really, really tough. But I don't think I could ever find an ovarian remnant. I would never be able to do that.
I couldn't either.
No way.
Okay. All right. Final question. And I always save the most important one for last. So if you could choose one to have as a patient, would you rather treat Gizmo from the Gremlins movie or Falcor from the Neverending Story?
Falcor.
Well, everybody wants a luck dragon.
Oh my god, I love that. I love that dragon. I would be so excited.
Well, thank you so much again for joining us. This was so much fun.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Thanks again to today's guest for joining us. And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. While you're there, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review us. You can also listen to our podcast on our website at cliniciansbrief.com/podcasts. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Clinicians Brief and on Instagram at clinicians.brief or drop us a line at podcast@briefmedia.com. Clinicians Brief the Podcast is a Brief Media production, produced by Alexis Ussery, sound by Randall Stupka, and hosted by me, Dr. Alyssa Watson.